Last week, Pastor Jeff introduced us to the book of Ecclesiastes. He described it as a dark, sobering book, one that will not be easy reading. In fact, we're meant to struggle, wrestle with the book, and that's how our faith grows. Now, if we skip to the end of the book, we would see that there are two voices in this book, two voices, but one hand writing this book. The first voice is the narrator. He appears in the beginning of the book, at the end of the book, and in the middle in chapter 7. And the other voice is someone who is introduced to us as the preacher or the teacher. The Hebrew word is koheleth, and it would seem, based on chapter 12, that the story is being told by a man who is an old man. His life experience has been very full and rich with mixed fruit. And we learn that this man is speaking to his son, and he wants to impart to his son wisdom that he says is like nails, meaning it's sharp and pointed, but it's also like goads. In other words, it's going to prod him into looking at aspects of life that as a young man, the son is probably not inclined to look at these things. And so this narrator wants us to understand that it's so important that we pay attention to what he's saying if we are to benefit from this book. I remember a few years ago, Marie and I were on a commercial flight flying from Denver, Colorado to Aspen, Colorado, over the Rocky Mountains. It's a magnificent flight. It takes about 30 or 40 minutes. There was a flight attendant who came on the intercom, and she looked like she had been doing this for a long, long time, perhaps a little too long, and was a little bored with the job, especially these little commuter flights. And she comes on the intercom, and she says, "Please pretend to pay attention to me while I review the safety features of this aircraft. In the unlikely event of a water landing," and here we're flying over the Rocky Mountains, and you can just see her, "I gotta do this, you know, to earn a paycheck. There is a flotation device underneath the seat." Now then, you need to know that turbulence is normal this time of the year in the Rocky Mountains. So don't get worried if the plane starts to bounce up and down a lot. Now, she said nothing about the more likely chance of flying right into a mountain. She's completely silenced about that. But I thought about that. Please pretend to pay attention while I review the safety features of this aircraft. And this book, the book of Ecclesiastes, is really written by an old man to his son, a younger man. It's written by a person who's living in the second half of life, as we say it today. It's a book that I feel that you cannot actually properly teach until you are in the second half of life. I remember first teaching this as a course at Harvest Bible University about 7 years ago. And then I taught it again about 3 years ago. And each time I go through it, I realize, oh my goodness, I was not prepared to teach this book 6 years ago, or 7 years ago, or 3 years ago. For those of you that are living in the first half of life, please pretend to pay attention while I share with you some truths about life that you probably don't want to see. We are meant to struggle with this book. Now, the book's theme is set forth in the second verse. Meaningless. Meaningless. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Aren't you glad you came to church this morning? Aren't you blessed to learn that life is meaningless, that there's no point to it all? What use do we have with a book that begins like this? The reader of Ecclesiastes is repeatedly bombarded by this refrain. In fact, it is used 38 times. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Life, we learn, is hebel. That's the Hebrew word. It means vapor, smoke, a wild goose chase. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. How could a true believer say such a thing? It's clear that the narrator wants his son to understand that he's speaking here of a man who was Solomon or someone like Solomon. How could Solomon, the wise man that he was, say something like this? And check this out. Chapter 1, verse 14. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. Now, one of his favorite words is the word behold. It's the Hebrew word hene, which means check this out. Look at this. All is vanity. And look at chapter 2, verse 17. It gets worse. So I hated life. For the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me. A word that means a terrible burden. Because everything is futility and striving after wind. Now at this point, if you're like me, you're saying, wait a minute. I don't agree that life is vanity, that there's no point to it all, that it's all meaningless. What we want to write into the text at this point is the word in big letters, unless. But it's not there. It comes later in the book. And we're in these early chapters, we're meant to struggle with this for a while. And I tell you, I'm up here in the pulpit wanting, let me get to the unless. Life has no meaning, no value, no point. Your life has no value, no meaning, no point. Unless. But it's not in the text that is assigned to me. There's only a partial solution. So I'm not going to rob the people that are going to follow me in this pulpit of the joy of telling you what the unless is. We are meant to struggle with it. But are these not the words of an embittered cynic, a selfish and calloused old man who finds himself near the end of his life, bereft of wisdom, dignity, and any joy or satisfaction? He sounds more like a 20th century existentialist than a man of faith. Is the author speaking as a wise man or as a fool? The Christian philosopher Peter Kreeft says that Ecclesiastes is a bright book of life. It is bright precisely in its dazzling darkness. Ecclesiastes, he says, is a great, great book because it explores deeply and uncompromisingly a great, great question. What are our lives here under the sun for? Now, Kreeft goes on to say that really what the author of this book is doing is exposing a great cover-up. And that is, people believe that their life has meaning or value apart from God. And what he wants to do is blow our cover and expose this. And he will point us eventually to the great unless. But it is only suggested in these early chapters. As we shall see, the teacher paints a dark picture of life on this planet. His faith is hard-pressed by the seeming futility of life. In a just world, the wicked would be punished and the good would live long, happy, prosperous lives. But there are disturbing exceptions to this rule. Bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. It is all so absurd, so pointless. God is just. The teacher knows this, but there is so much injustice in the world. It just doesn't make sense. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. But as bleak as the outlook is, at intervals, there are clearings in the overcast, and we're going to see the first of these clearings this morning in chapter 2. Some light breaks through, and we begin to get a glimpse of the unless. Our life has no meaning, no value, unless. Solomon will encourage his readers, his son, to enjoy God's gifts when they come. Such moments are precious, but they are fleeting. They are beautiful in their time. And he will show us how to live life with joy and satisfaction, even in the face of unanswered questions, even in the face of a lot of stuff that we just don't understand, don't like, or can't explain. Life can be unfair, frustrating, bewildering, but a person can still do the right thing. Accept his or her lot in life, even enjoy it, and find strength to cope with life and all of its vicissitudes. Now, I'm going to give you a brief description here of the unless. The message of Ecclesiastes is that the course of life to be pursued is a God-centered life. But that's all we're going to say about that at this time. Now, Solomon's vantage point as he carries out his investigations is under the sun, an expression he uses some 30 times. Now, this phrase provides a frame of reference for his inquiry. It means the world that we can observe, or as far as we know, as far as human reasoning can take me. He wants to meet us on our own ground and say, as far as we can see, as far as we can determine, everything that exists and all that we see in this world amounts to no meaning, no purpose, or no value. Unless. Now, a second key phrase is used 7 times and expresses that same limitation. It's the phrase, I thought in my heart, or I said to myself. Now, this is Solomon's way of saying, these are my conclusions based on my observations and experience. This is far as my human reasoning can take me. This is the best thinking a man can do on his own. So here we have it, the results of the teacher's experimentation with life to see if it has any meaning. Now, in chapters 1 and 2, he embarks on a series of experiments. The first one we looked at was last week, and we saw that in chapter 1, verses 12 and through 14, and in the verses that preceded that. And that was, he looked into the realm of science and made a systematic study of the laws of nature. He says he searched, a Hebrew word meaning to seek the roots out of a matter. He explored, meaning to investigate a subject on all sides. And he investigated the natural world and how it works and still came to the conclusion that it's all vanity, meaningless. It doesn't point to any meaning or purpose in life. His next experiment was at the end of chapter 1. And that was in the area of wisdom and philosophy, the best of liberal arts education has to offer, as we would say today. Verse 16, he said, I said to myself, check it out, behold, hene, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me. He had every degree that was offered. He really studied. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. This means that he went to school and he studied the works of John Calvin, but then he also studied the works of Voltaire. And he wanted to learn it all. He wanted to see it from all sides. And this is what we do when we go to a college or university. We get all the perspectives and we have to make sense out of it. But he says, I realized that this also is striving after wind. Because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. Well, next, he asked the question, well, perhaps I can find meaning in joy and in pleasure. The pleasures of life. That's chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. When he says, I said to myself, he said, this is kind of a controlled experiment, he thinks. Let's try this out, and let's see what we can learn. Is there any meaning and real satisfaction in life by indulging in all the pleasures that this life has to offer? So enjoy yourself. And check this out. Hine, behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it's madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine. While my mind was guiding me wisely and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. Now, I don't know about you, but that has me scratching my head. How does wisdom guide a person to take hold of folly? In what kinds of situations will wisdom do that? And this is honestly a very difficult passage for Bible scholars. Some of them look at this and they take that very seriously and they say this must be some kind of a controlled experiment on the part of Solomon. He doesn't give himself over to drunkenness or to illegal pleasure, but he explores this as an option. In other words, within boundaries that God has allowed. Now, the Hebrew word translated pleasure is used frequently in this book. It also means joy. He looks at all the pleasures, the joys of life, and says, is there any meaning in any of this? Well, pleasure, as C.S. Lewis once observed, is God's invention, not the devil. So this view is a real option. Perhaps he is doing a controlled experiment. In chapter 2, verse 24, we learn that pleasure is good because God created it. We are wired for pleasure. It is man's portion, chapter 2, verse 10. It is God's gift, chapter 2, verses 24 and 26. Pleasure is good because it distracts us from the hardship and toil of life, chapter 5, verse 19. And when you get right down to it, pleasure is good because it feels good. That's in chapter 3, verse 12, verse 22, and chapter 5, verse 17. And so there are many good reasons that he gives in this book as to why we should receive joy and pleasure from God's hand and receive it gratefully and enjoy it. But the point he's making is that in making that the goal of life, meaning in life will always be elusive. You will never find satisfaction, never find meaning in life or purpose by pursuing God's gifts. You must pursue the giver. But again, we're moving into the unless, which he only hints at in this chapter. Now here's one Hebrew scholar, his take on this passage, and it's a possible way we might look at this. He says, to nourish my flesh with wine, which is the literal Hebrew, stimulate my flesh means to nourish it with wine, should be taken as a reference to a consumption of wine which enables a man to get the highest possible enjoyment by a careful use of it, so that appetite is sharpened, enjoyment enhanced, and the finest bouquets sampled and enjoyed. Boy, he sounds like a true wine connoisseur. Approximating or falling into drunkenness is plainly not under consideration. The very thought of such crude extravagance is barred by the expression, my mind was still keeping control by means of wisdom. In other words, this is a carefully controlled experiment. But as Jeff pointed out last week, we can't experiment with sin and expect to maintain objectivity about it. Many have tried this, and many have been pulled into it. It is playing with fire. And so the language of this text suggests that Koheleth, the teacher, did not merely experiment or dabble in the pursuit of pleasure. He immersed himself in it. He gave himself completely to it. So perhaps his use of wisdom in this context is meant to be ironic. And so we ask ourselves, what kind of wisdom is this that instructs us to take hold of folly? That completely contradicts what Solomon said in the book of Proverbs. And that is especially that if we have two choices in life, the way of wisdom and the way of folly, and he says one is like the Lady Wisdom beckoning to you, calling you to take her path, but Lady Folly calling you also, beckoning you to take her path, and we must choose. We also learn in chapter 2 that not only did he experiment with wine and pleasures of all kinds, he experimented with sex. We learn in Ecclesiastes 2:8 that he helped himself to the pleasures of men, he says, many concubines, a much understated statement there. In fact, we learn from 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's 1,000 women. Chapter 11, verse 1 and 2 of 1 Kings says, "Now King Solomon loved many foreign women. Solomon held fast to these in love." That's a Hebrew way of saying he had sex with them. Sex with 1,000 women. That can't be good for you. In spite of what our culture says today. In fact, we learn in verse 4 of 1 Kings 11, "For it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God." If this is Solomon, and this was his experiment, it backfired on him. He gave himself to find meaning in sexual pleasure, but in the end it destroyed him. I think that probably what we are to understand here is that everything God made was good. It is good in its place, but bad when it's out of its place. A fire is good. It can cook your meal and warm your home, or it can burn your house down and kill your family. Likewise, water can quench your thirst, and it's essential for life, but it can drown you and destroy your home with a flood. So it is with the pleasures of life. In 6 different sections of the book, our teacher advises his readers to enjoy life now and be grateful for God's gifts. Now, this is not an invitation to self-indulgent hedonism, but the joyful outlook of the believer who accepts life as God's gift to enjoy and employ for his glory. God's gifts are wonderful blessings in their proper place. Unfortunately, our culture has made a goddess of self-indulgence, sensuality, worshiping sexual pleasure, rather than receiving it with gratitude and enjoying it within God-given boundaries. Like all things God created, sex is good in its proper place. But sometimes we love a good thing too much or in the wrong way, and then it becomes an idol. And so then the teacher embarks on another experiment, great building projects. That's in verses 4 through 7. We also learned that he pursued great wealth and riches. That's verses 8 and 9. "Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me." But again, what kind of wisdom is this if we make those things the goal of our lives? "All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. no limits, no boundaries. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. I owe it to myself, it's my reward. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. It didn't mean a thing. I'm left empty-handed. It's striving or chasing after the wind. And he, in the next section, up to verse 17, he says, the wise man or the fool, it's better to be wise. He knows that you should tell the truth and not tell a lie. He knows that it's best to work hard and not be lazy. But in the end, we're all left in the same place. We're all going to die. What does it all mean? What is the meaning of your life? And what do you do with the time that you have? When my mom was in the hospital after she had had a series of heart attacks, and it was clear that she was dying, the family had to make that decision. That was not her decision. We made that decision to take her off the respirator, and if she had another one of these episodes, to not resuscitate her. It was a very difficult decision to make. And I was in the room with her after they removed the breathing apparatus, and she was a little bit cogent. And I was with her when she realized for the first time that she was dying. The hospice nurse came in, and she introduced herself as such. My mom immediately recognized the implication of that word hospice. And she said, "Dying?" And the hospice nurse said, "Are you afraid of dying?" And mom said, "No, but why am I still here?" And the hospice nurse, very wise, said, "Because your time is not finished yet." Well, her time was finished about a week later, in her bed, in her apartment, Cliff Drive across from the Lawn Bowlers, her beloved Heisler Park. After we had that discussion, Mom asked me another question. Who won? You see, the Lakers were playing the Celtics in the seventh game of the NBA Finals. My mom was a huge Celtics fan. And what I told her gave her tremendous joy. The Celtics beat the Lakers by over 30 points. And she said, "Oh boy." And she said, "How did my boy do?" That was a reference to Ray Allen, the point guard for the Celtics. "Oh, he was spectacular." She said, "Good boy." Mom had found simple joys and pleasures in life. She loved the Rose Garden by Las Brisas. We'd watch basketball on TV, and she found beauty in a perfectly executed pick and roll. She thought Karl Malone, who played for the Utah Jazz, was the most beautiful creature God ever created. She was a 78-year woman waiting outside the locker room after a Laker game, waiting for the mailman to come out. And he comes out, the mailman was the nickname for Karl Malone. And she says, yells, this 78-year-old woman saying, "I love you, mailman! You're the most beautiful creature ever created." She found joy in things that were just amazing, and she maintained that to the very end. Now, what Solomon is telling us here is that if we seek meaning in life through the simple pleasures of life, we will never find it. But if we look to the giver of the gift and say, "Thank you, Lord, for this beautiful creature, Karl Malone. Thank you for this rose. Thank you for the sunset. Thank you for the flotilla of pelicans gracefully gliding across the waves." If we do those things, we understand that God has built into this troublesome, bewildering life of ours, things that sustain us because we recognize that there are his gifts. Verse 24, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I've seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? In our joys and pleasures of daily life, don't leave him out. See, there's the unless. Just slightly developed at this stage. You can wear yourself out trying to find the solution of life in nature, philosophy, business, or history, or in pleasure. You can make the pursuit of luxury or money or financial security your chief aim, but you will end up being frustrated unless God is at the center. And that's the message of the book. Now, Will Durant was a prolific American writer, historian, and philosopher. He is best known for his 11-volume, The Story of Civilization. My mom gave me a set. It takes up a huge space in my bookshelf. It looks very impressive. It was written in collaboration with his wife, Ariel, and published between 1935 and 1975. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1968 for his work. In the fall of 1930, he was outside his home in Lake Hill, New York, raking leaves, and he was approached by a well-dressed man who told him in a quiet tone that he was going to kill himself unless someone could give him any good reasons for not doing that. Haunted by that encounter, Durant contacted 100 prominent people in the arts, education, politics, religion, sciences, athletics, and challenged them to respond not only to the fundamental question of life's meaning, but also to relate specifically how each one found meaning for their own lives. Now, he turned their answers into his own book entitled On the Meaning of Life, published in 1932. It's been long out of print, but recently republished by Promethean Press. You can download it on Amazon.net. The upshot of his effort was that many really famous people, including Bertrand Russell, Gandhi, George Bernard Shaw, were too busy to think deeply about the meaning of life. He got only 25 responses. And their terse, rambling responses shed little light on the roots of their own frenetic behavior. Why do they do what they do? Many of the correspondents frankly admitted in one fashion or another that they were too busy to answer the question, what is the meaning of life? Here is part of Durant's summary. The growth and spread of knowledge for which so many idealists and reformers prayed has resulted in a disillusionment which has almost broken the spirit of our race. Astronomers have told us that human affairs constitute but a moment in the trajectory of a star. Geologists have told us that civilization is but a precarious interlude between ice ages. Biologists have told us that all life is war, a struggle for existence among individuals, groups, nations, alliances, and species. Historians have told us that progress is a delusion whose glory ends in inevitable decay. Psychologists have told us that the will and the self are the helpless instruments of heredity and environment. Faith and hope disappear. Doubt and despair are the order of the day. This is the essential diagnosis of our time. Oy, vanity, vanity. All is vanity. This is looking at life under the sun without light from God's revelation. Now, I know one scientist who has come to a very different view of life. He has a PhD in biochemistry from Caltech. He is an elder in our church, and he is the head of our healing prayer ministry, and he's my good friend. It's Lauren Hatlin. He and I have been on a quest to find the perfect latte. And we found it. But we're not telling you where it is because we don't want this place to get discovered. But we have found the perfect latte. And I wanted to tell Lauren's story, and I thought, well, wait a minute, why don't we just have Lauren tell his own story? So Lauren.
Thank you, Steve. In 1976, I was an assistant research professor at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in La Jolla, California. I was doing basic cancer research. After getting my doctorate from Caltech in biochemistry, I came to the Salk Institute and decided at that point to devote my life to cancer research, which seemed like a noble, worthy effort. In my research, I worked with a mouse model, and I worked with a number of mouse tumor cell lines. One was a mouse lymphoma line called EL4, and I also worked with some mouse myeloma lines, which were antibody-producing cells that I needed in my research. The Salk Institute was a very heady intellectual atmosphere. I knew Nobel Prize winners. I'd had a Nobel Prize winner on my thesis committee. We had world-famous speakers flowing in and out through the Salk Institute, and it was a great place to be. During that year, 1976, my father-in-law, whom I loved like a father, came down with multiple myeloma. And my mother came down with lymphoma. Both of them received medical treatment, and my mother received some alternative therapies. At one point, I could see that their diseases were progressing and they weren't getting any better, and I went to make an appointment with Jonas Salk, and I went to his office and I talked to him and I said, I know you're really well connected with the medical research community. Do you know anybody that has experimental treatments for multiple myeloma, somebody who could help my father-in-law's disease? And he said, no, I don't. I'm not aware of anything like that. But I'm sorry to hear about your father-in-law. I said, thank you. Within a year, my father-in-law died at the hospital down the street here, Laguna Beach. And my mother died at the hospice in Santa Barbara. And it absolutely devastated me. Just took the heart out of me for doing cancer research or even doing science. Here I devoted my life to doing this, and I couldn't help my two of the people I love the most. Medical help was not fruitful. Science wasn't fruitful. I was at the point where it was vanity, vanity, all is vanity. What am I here for? What's going on? The death of those two family members didn't have a positive effect. It drove me back into the arms of God. I started attending church regularly, and I went to a church that had a contemporary worship service that ministered to me. I started reading the Bible again and finding comfort in Scripture and finding things in the Bible I'd never read before. And then in 1978, I had an encounter with God, the Holy Spirit, which totally transformed my life. But that's a story for another time. Part of that transformation was that I found I was gifted in teaching, doing healing and deliverance ministry. And I had a small group in my home that we ministered to lots and lots of people, and I found that ministry was very satisfying and very, very pleasing to me. I was still doing science because I needed to make a living, but science was no longer my life. Science was a way of making a living, just the same way that tent making was a way for Paul to make a living. It wasn't his life. Jesus was my life. He was the center and focus of my life. and I derive great pleasure in doing what I, in the ministry I just described. And I fell into a common mistake. I divided my life up into the secular and the sacred. At some point, I began resenting the fact that, you know, I really would rather be doing full-time ministry than doing this science stuff. I began resenting that. And then God showed me some stuff in the scriptures. I got an attitude adjustment. And here's a scripture that did it. Whatever your task, that's whatever your task, work heartily as serving the Lord and not men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. I started committing my day to the Lord and working as unto the Lord. So when I was doing science, I was working as unto the Lord. Prayer ministry, I was working as unto the Lord. Everything I did, I was working as unto the Lord. As Christians, our lives really should be seamless. As we work as unto the Lord, our whole lives are sacred. We are God's extraordinary people doing ordinary tasks as unto the Lord. And that makes our life sacred. So maybe you're the mother who's homeschooling her children, but also teaching Sunday school. You're the father who's working in the marketplace to provide for his family, where you're leading worship on Sunday morning. You're the young woman who works with autistic children, but also participates in the high school ministry. You're the writer who takes a break from writing Christian novels to serve meals in the friendship shelter. You're the dentist who takes time off from his practice, goes overseas to give medical and dental care to the poor and needy. Your lives are devoted to the Lord. There's no division between the secular and the sacred. At the end of your days, if you work as unto the Lord, you can look back on your life, and you're not going to be in the place where you say, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. I don't think so. Instead, there'd be one who says to you, the one that you've been working for, he'll say to you, well done, thou good and faithful servant.